Inside a snow bomb today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Yeah, it is snowing here in Boston and the wind is howling. Hello, bomb cyclone.
It's when the pressure in the center of a storm system drops rapidly, causing the air around it to rush in really quickly and the wind to really pick up and intensify. It's sort of the same effect as if an ice skater brings his or her arms into the body and that sort of force builds up.
And speaking of the white stuff, you're usually guaranteed to see snow in Moscow in the winter. But there haven't been any Omar Sharif moments so far this year.
If you want to feel like this, you're lost here. Yeah, it's exactly not the year to come to feel like in Dr. Zhivago.
Plus, why New Jersey is a global food hub. It's all ahead today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World, and our world here in Boston. If you'd asked me a few hours ago, I'd have said hard to tell because you couldn't see more than 50 feet in front of you with all the snow. So let's begin today talking about the weather and a whole new vocabulary that includes cyclone, bomb, snow bomb, bombogenesis. You see a pattern? The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler is with me. Carolyn, not a very livable planet here in the Northeast today.
I guess it depends on your perspective. We do have a ton of wind and blowing snow, really blizzard conditions out there. But I think some people in the South are excited who don't usually get to see snow.
So. Now, I just saw a picture of some guy skiing off the back of a truck in South Carolina. So they're having fun, definitely.
All a matter of perspective.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on how much snow you usually see this time of year. So bomb, cyclone, snow bomb. Where are these words coming from?
They're popping up in headlines a lot this week, but the word bomb has been used to describe rapidly intensifying storms for decades. It was first published in a paper in 1980 by a MIT professor who was writing about explosive cyclogenesis, which is the meteorological term for this.
Wow.
And it's basically when the pressure in the center of a storm system drops rapidly, causing the air around it to rush in really quickly and the wind to really pick up and intensify.
All right, Carolyn, time for the climate change question, because I ask this pretty much every time we do an extreme weather story, but we've had a lot of severe winter weather here on the East Coast over the past several years. So is this linked to climate change?
I'm going to get to that in just a second, but this all sort of hinges on the jet stream. So I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that.
All right.
The jet stream creates our weather here in the Northern Hemisphere. It's this wind that blows west to east. In, quote, normal years, it blows generally straight from west to east, but sometimes it can get wavy. So it can go up north or dip down south. And when it dips down south, cold air from the Arctic can seep down into North America. And with this wavy shape, it can also stall out and linger for weeks at a time. So this wavy jet stream has created abnormally cold weather in the eastern U.S. for a handful of winters for the past decade or so.
Okay, so that's a jet stream. How does climate change play into all of this weather we're seeing?
There still is scientific debate about this. There's a camp of scientists who believe that this wavy jet stream is caused by natural weather variability, and it's just the chaos of our weather systems. The other camp thinks that climate change is one of the factors that's fueling increasing waviness in the jet stream. And that camp has had increasing evidence in the past few years to support their stance.
Okay, explain the link here. How exactly might climate change be making the jet stream wavier?
So the jet stream is wind, and it's caused by the temperature difference between the warm tropics and the cold Arctic. You can think of it as sort of the boundary between warm and cold. Jennifer Francis from Rutgers is one of the top researchers in this field, and she told me this boundary weakens when it's warmer in the Arctic due to climate change.
So if we warm the Arctic much faster, then obviously that temperature difference is going to be smaller. And so we'd expect to see the winds of the jet stream be weaker in response.
That weaker jet stream is what causes this meandering from north to south and the hanging out of cold, severe weather over places like Boston for weeks at a time.
Yeah, which is what we are expecting tomorrow. Plunging temperatures down to single digits. You know, with all the snow, I can't wait. The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
We may not like the prospect of more intense winters, but I know who might. Muscovites. Residents of Moscow not only expect a ton of snow in the winter, they love it. Snow is in their blood. Ivan Boyko is a Russian photographer and lives in Moscow. His specialty, in fact, is winter scenes. Ivan, how deep is the snow today in Moscow?
Well, I would say zero deep. We have absolutely no snow, I would say.
And there's no snow piled up from weeks past, like in the gutters or something?
Absolutely nothing like this.
What's going on?
Well, no snow.
It just hasn't snowed. Are officials expressing any concern over this aberration?
Not especially, but it's indeed very untypical for this time of year and for this geography that we have absolutely no snow. It's quite a rare thing, I would say.
Is it cold, at least?
No, not at the moment. It's like plus one, maybe, or something.
Yeah, so just a little above 32 Fahrenheit. Are Russians or Muscovites talking about the lack of snow and climate change kind of in the same breath? Are they kind of seeing it that way?
You know, strangely, not exactly. They obviously feel the change because me, myself, I perfectly remember when I was a child of maybe 10 in the city when they used to clean streets and there were piles of snow aside of the street. They were higher than a 10-year-old boy. And we have absolutely nothing like this, some last maybe 7-8 years. If we have a snow, we have a pretty modest snow, I would say like a Central Europe maybe or something.
So you're saying kind of like the big snowdrifts that you remember as a kid that doesn't really happen much anymore?
No, last 10 years it doesn't. And people see these changes and then kind of complain about it because they are not really used in this geography and climate to such a small snow winters. But somehow in general talks, they don't really connect it to global warmth.
How many winter photo shoots have you done this year?
Well, not much, actually. I've been on a commission November, December, not far from here in St. Petersburg, especially like waiting for winter because it was part of what's supposed to be done. And I cannot say it was really successful because hardly one maybe cold morning. That was it.
So as a kind of winter snow photographer, how dependent are you on the weather for your work? Like if it doesn't snow, do you get paid?
Well, it depends on agreement. I'm not exactly like especially winter photographer. I do a lot of landscapes and obviously winter scenes are part of my job.
Mm. Why do you like photographing winter so much?
Well, it's pretty special, I think, for the way it looks and the way it feels. It's really specific, I find, like overall as a mood and the stories around it and the way people feel about it.
So what's the general mood in Moscow right now without snow?
Well, people are very festive, I would say. I've just been in the center of the city. There are a lot of people outside with children and families having walks and, I don't know, having fun around.
So people in Moscow are still festive. What does Moscow look like in winter with no snow? Is there still kind of a sense of romanticism?
I'd say so if you love the city, if you're familiar with it, or if you feel it in some way, yes.
Yeah, but if you go as a tourist and are expecting that Dr. Zhivago look, you're out of luck this year, I guess.
No, you're lost. If you want to feel like this, you're lost here. Yeah, it's exactly not the year to come to feel like in Dr. Zhivago.
Ivan Boyko, a photographer in Moscow who specializes in winter scenes. And all I can say is let it snow, Ivan. Wishing you all the white stuff you want. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
We heard earlier about the impact climate change might be having on this winter's severe weather here in the eastern U.S. But talk about severe weather with a climate change connection. Puerto Rico is still struggling to recover from last summer's massive back-to-back hurricanes. They devastated the island and knocked out power for most residents. More than 3 months later, the lights are still not on for almost half of them. And that's been a massive setback for the island. But it's also an opportunity for something that could help make Puerto Rico more resilient in the long term: solar power with battery storage. Here's more from Daniela Cheslow.
Four technicians heave a Tesla Powerwall solar battery pack onto a wall in a closet in a San Juan suburb. This white metal beast weighs 275 pounds and can store enough electricity to keep a house running from sunset to sunrise. Installer Alexis Portalatin says he leaves the plastic wrap on so the owner can peel it off.
It's like when you buy a new car, you had the plastic, brand new car.
And the costs are also almost like a new car. The Tesla battery costs close to $10,000. I go to the kitchen to meet the people who spent that kind of money. Rosa Lopez and Jose Quiñones listen to a radio interview about solar technology in Puerto Rico while their daughter toddles around them. They're both engineers and early green energy adopters. 2 years ago, they took out a loan to install solar panels on their roof. But those panels only work properly if they're connected to the power grid, which used to go down a lot, even before Hurricanes Irma and Maria.
It was like a couple of hours if they have to fix something, but nothing major until these two hurricanes.
After the storms hit in September, the electricity was out in the neighborhood for more than 3 months. And that even limited the use of their grid-connected solar system. That's why Lopez and Quiñones bought the Tesla. It's expensive, but the family was already spending $400 a week in fuel for a generator.
I was looking to see how can I use the full power of the panels, and the only way is installing batteries.
When Maria came and made all the mess, we started calculating, and we understand that we need to make this investment.
They bought their battery system from a company called New Energy. Before the hurricane, the company sold maybe 5 batteries a month. But in October, CEO Alejandro Uriarte says he sold 200.
Before Maria, nobody wanted to buy storage because it was too expensive. And now everybody wants to buy storage. And it's not an issue now of saving money, it's just an issue of having electricity.
Uriarte says he's lined up investors for a new solar microgrid with battery storage for a community of 3,000 homes. It could run independently, so if the main grid went down, the microgrid would stay up.
We're trying to be the first one to do a microgrid, a big microgrid here. We will become like a small utility.
Outside investors have similar ideas. I met Blake Riquetta on a balmy evening in Old San Juan. He's with the German solar battery company Sonnen. After Hurricane Maria, Sonnen donated 8 batteries for solar energy to community kitchens and health clinics. Now the company hopes to work with Puerto Rico's government to convert an old U.S. naval base into a solar-powered housing development.
We should do lots of these new construction projects. And of course, that gives you a little miniature taste of what the future grid would look like.
Riquetta says Sonnen has sold more than 200 batteries in Puerto Rico since the storm.
Which is a really big business for us.
I'm sorry, but to my ear, that sounds tiny.
It is tiny, yeah. The entire energy storage industry is tiny. It's embryonic.
That's why backers of solar are excited about what's happening in Puerto Rico. It's a laboratory, and potentially a very big one. Last month, the governors of New York and Puerto Rico announced a plan to transform the island's power system and integrate solar power and storage in remote areas. It's a long shot. The plan would require billions of dollars in federal funding that may never materialize. Still, San Juan's mayor, Carmen Yulín Cruz, thinks solar has real promise, at least in her city. I met her just after she threw the ceremonial first pitch for a celebrity softball game.
Yulín Cruz!
The game is a needed morale booster for a city still struggling from the hurricanes. As of early January, Yulín says about 40% of San Juan still doesn't have power. The mayor dreams of transforming the city's electric supply. Tesla has already donated solar panels to run a hospital. A solar industry group working with the Clinton Foundation will power San Juan's main market. And Yulín says she'd love to hear about Blake Riquetta's plans to bring Sonnen microgrids to Puerto Rico.
You know, tell him to call me.
Yulín says outside investors would need to work alongside Puerto Ricans. And she says the island's debt has to be erased so that local governments can invest in these new systems.
But this could be a wonderful showcase for solar energy for the rest of the world.
Mayor Yulín says the Puerto Rico that she knew before Hurricane Maria will never be back. And she says in many ways, that's a good thing. For the world, Daniela Cheslow, San Juan.
Coming up on the show, how the child of Indian immigrants made history by winning a spelling bee in 1985. That story's up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. You have to know the past to understand the present. Carl Sagan said that, but it's kind of common sense. Digging through the past can also produce some good stories, like this next one you're going to hear, courtesy of the BBC's Witness podcast. My colleague Farhana Haider takes us back to 1985 and the first time the U.S. National Spelling Bee was won by a kid of South Asian background.
Nah. Can I have a definition? a video by the Scripps National Spelling Bee commemorating the competition, which has been held almost every year in the US since 1925. Balu Natarajan, a Chicago native, was 13 years old when he became Spelling Bee champion. His winning word was...
So the winning word was milieu. The way that the pronouncer pronounced the word, he added a slight French flair when he pronounced it. He said milieu, and I was not placing it at that moment. I asked some questions, and then at some point it clicked for me what it was and spelled it really as a question. I said M-I-L-I-E-U with a question mark, and they said that I had it right.
Balu's parents grew up in the southern Indian state of Kerala and came to America in the early 1970s. They knew it was essential that their children mastered English properly if they were going to do well in life.
As long as I can remember, 4 or 5 years old, the importance of proper English was stressed at home. As kids, I remember going to Thanksgiving dinner when I was 5 years old to my friend's grandmother's house. And I remember going home and my mom basically made me write a report on this visit. I was deeply resentful of having to do this, but it was important at home that we were able to express ourselves and use the English language in just wonderful ways. And so then in fifth grade, the Spelling Bee competition came to town. And my mom helped me to study, and I won the school Spelling Bee after that.
The National Spelling Bee is a knockout competition. One word spelt incorrectly and you're out, which means the children and their parents have to put in a lot of hours preparing.
There was quite a bit of studying after school and building a word bank, reviewing old lists of competition words that had been called, trying to determine patterns. I mean, that's how we did it back then. Now the competition is tougher, and so innate ability won't get most people very far. They have to learn rules of various languages. They have to learn Latin and Greek and other roots. They have to build a word bank of thousands and thousands more words than those of us did in the competition back in the 80s.
Hooked on spelling bees from the age of 10, Balu first entered the Scripps National Spelling Bee in 1983 and again in 1984, coming in 45th and 63rd place respectively.
The first year, I missed out on a Yiddish word and then tried to focus on that. And then the following year, I missed out on a Yiddish word again. And so my parents looked at me after that and said, "Are you sure you want to do this? This is a lot of time." And but they left it to me, and I said, "Yes, I do want to try again." They gave me their full support, which is a lot. For me, the first 2 years inspired me more. It made me want it more.
In 1985, Balu made it to the final in Washington, D.C.
Winning was amazing. The third place winner that year was also there for the third time. And so it could easily have been one word that tripped me up instead of one word that tripped her up. That easily could have been her or a number of other people hoisting that trophy on the stage, because all it takes is one word you don't know.
So how did you manage to hold your nerve on that big stage? And what was it that you were seeing?
Bright lights. There was a whole media corner where the photojournalists and videographers were all there. What we could see on stage was really just those bright lights. And so my focus was look at the judges, look at the pronouncer, don't look directly into the bright lights, and just block everything out. And so immediately after getting the word correct, I remember what I did was I turned around and I shook hands with Kate Langley, who was the second place winner. The rest is surreal. I don't remember a whole lot of the rest, because the next thing that happens is somebody comes by with the trophy and they hand it to you, and then somebody else is bringing parents on stage. And so then it was really just a blur.
The win also opened up other opportunities.
I was able to appear on ABC's Good Morning America, and I was able to appear on NBC's Tonight Show. Within a couple of hours, we were in a car to the airport because we were flying to New York that night. And then I was on Good Morning America the next day. And then the following Tuesday, I was in Los Angeles filming with Johnny Carson.
From Hollywood, The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson.
And so to meet a bunch of celebrities at the age of 13 and travel to be on television was pretty wild. I had this little autograph book. We all did in the spelling bee. We all had this little autograph book, and we would have other competitors would sign it. And so I took this autograph book and I gave it to Johnny Carson's manager probably about 5 minutes before I was going on stage. And he signed it saying this. He said, "Balu, so nice to share you with 18 million viewers." And I had to go on stage within a few minutes. I had read this thing, and I was a little overwhelmed. 18 million, that's kind of daunting.
I think it's fair enough if you got stage fright at that stage.
Since Balu Natarajan's win in 1985, the competition has been dominated by winners of South Asian descent.
If you spell this next word correctly, we will declare you the 2017 Scripps National Spelling Bee champion.
2017 winner Ananya Vinay became the 13th Indian American to win the title.
She knows what it means.
N-A-R-O-C-A-I-N.
That is correct.
Congratulations.
So why does Balu think Americans of South Asian descent have excelled in the spelling bee?
The Indian American community is interested in this. They have successfully been able to compete in such competitions. And so I think that provides a degree of confidence. And I think that there are definitely various venues, be it the North-South Foundation competitions, the South Asian Spelling Bee, for folks of South Asian descent to practice.
And did you feel the significance of being the first Indian American to win?
It was a big deal in my Indian American community. That summer after I won, it felt like every weekend a different Indian organization was asking me to come and speak at one of their events. My dad would help me write those speeches, and he would make sure that I stressed the importance of not only English, but the importance of maintaining our cultural background and family and old traditions while adapting the traditions in the United States.
So you became a role model for the community.
That summer, it became very clear that I had to do something good with that responsibility. I had to be quite positive and essentially be the role model that I was expected to be. And so I've always thanked the universe for what I've been able to achieve, potentially because of the confidence that that gave me.
Balu Natarajan won the Scripps National Spelling Bee on his third try in 1985. He's now a doctor in Chicago. He shared his story with Farhana Haider and the BBC podcast Witness. By the way, amazing spellers, the next Scripps National Spelling Bee is in late May, and applications are being accepted through March 23rd. I'm Marco Werman. American food headed overseas.
Gatorade, Skippy peanut butter, Quaker oatmeal, more Gatorade.
Shipping from warehouses in New Jersey
to Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Kuwait.
And importing food from places across the globe. How New Jersey became America's global food hub. That's ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Who will stay? Who will go? Who can work, and at what job? Questions that have been on the minds of a lot of people since President Trump was elected, promising to tighten U.S. immigration and visa policies. One group of people who are anxious about all this, H-1B visa holders and their families. The H-1B is a 3-year renewable work visa for foreign nationals in specialized occupations, including those people with high-tech skills. Their spouses are typically given a different kind of visa, an H-4, and under President Obama, some of them were allowed to work here too. But now the Trump administration is reportedly close to barring spouses from employment while they're in the U.S. That would be devastating for Neha Mahajan. She lives in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Her husband holds an H-1B visa. Now she wonders if she'll ever be employable here. This is not how Mahajan imagined her future in 2008 when she arrived in the U.S. at the age of 25.
I was extremely excited to come to the U.S. I thought I'm going to go out there, live the American dream, and use my skills as a TV journalist. I said to myself, maybe CNN is not too far-fetched. Maybe I'll be able to intern there. I was told that maybe I'll not be allowed to work, but I was like, maybe it wouldn't affect me that much because there is a way that I could apply for a green card through my husband's employer.
Right.
And I didn't know at that time that the backlogs were so bad that it would take nearly 50 to 70 years for anybody from India who came here on H-1B visa for their green cards to get processed. And I had no idea that it will be so long that I will lose all my productive years just waiting in limbo.
So you came here because your husband had the H-1B visa. You came with him,
right.
But you were barred from working once you got here.
That's right. Yes.
Which means you couldn't do things like open a bank account or get a social security number or even intern anywhere.
Absolutely.
Things changed, though, in 2015 under the Obama administration. What happened?
So here comes an opening, a beam of light, a miracle. Years of advocacy turns out that we are given a Band-Aid fix. All the H-1B holders who were now in line for green card, their spouses were allowed to start working.
Did you get a job after that? Did the CNN dream come true?
The CNN dream didn't come true, sadly. You know, I had moved on. So I had ventured out into marketing and public relations, and I was able to land this job at a firm.
Right. That was at Global Data Management. Two months ago, though, you were asked to resign from that job. What happened?
Yeah, in December, I was asked to resign. I was cited budget cuts. That was the reason that was given to me.
Does that have anything to do with the visa situation?
It could be. I'm not sure. It could be, though.
So in recent days, the Department of Homeland Security has announced a plan to prevent people like you from working in the U.S. What exactly are they proposing?
So what they're proposing is this Obama-era law, the executive order that came by. They are basically repealing it. They've proposed to revoke that whole law.
Now, your husband's H-1B visa is also uncertain. What's he thinking right now?
To be very honest, we're taking every day as it comes. For the past 10 years, that's how it has been. You have to understand, Marco, that we were invited to come and work here in this country and to make it our own. It's not an easy decision to make, to uproot yourself from your country of origin and to start living here. It's kind of playing with all of our lives, all of our plans. Hundreds of H-1B visas are invited to come and work in the U.S. You know, they are evaluated. It's not that anybody and everybody can apply. You're evaluated on the basis of your skill sets.
I mean, the bottom line, of course, is who gets jobs, especially well-paying jobs. If you look at Save Jobs USA, a group of former Southern California Edison IT workers, they claim they lost their jobs to H-1B workers, and they've now sued Department of Homeland Security. What would you say to those workers and their spouses?
There's a lot of misconception out there. H-1B visa holders are also doctors, and there are thousands of them. And they work in the remote areas of the U.S., helping patients, helping people. And because of all these complications around immigration, many of their work authorizations have been rejected and they've been asked to leave the country too. Everybody gets affected by this.
So now, Neha, you're in this limbo. Do you think about returning to India with dread or do you see an upside?
We expanded our family here. We bought a house here. It's been 10 years that we've lived here, all our productive years. And things have changed so much back in India, too. So we do not belong to India as much as I would love to. And neither have we fitted into the U.S. as such. And all these immigration decisions that come and go are affecting our lives every single day.
So you don't see any upside to going back to India?
Culturally, I've alienated from India also. Mm. And my older daughter, she's 11 right now. She was 2 when she came here. She doesn't consider India to be her home. My other daughter is U.S. born. She would be considered as a non-resident of India back there. So we'll have to take each day as it comes and keep going forward.
Neha Mahajan, thanks very much. We wish you good luck.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Marco.
Neha Mahajan lives in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Her husband is an H-1B visa holder. And we stay in the Garden State for our next story. It's part of our 50 States project, looking at how globalization is impacting communities and states across the country. So here's something you may not know about New Jersey. The state bills itself as America's import-export hub for food. The world's Jason Margolis has more.
At the warehouse of food exporter Y International USA, the shelves are lined with brand name American products.
Gatorade, Skippy peanut butter, Splenda sugar substitutes, Quaker oatmeal.
Scott Weber shows me around this new warehouse in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. For the past year, workers have been repackaging boxes and putting Arabic labeling on American foods bound for the Middle East.
In Saudi Arabia, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and Oman.
Why set up shop in New Jersey? Simple.
Location. We have the biggest ports in the world. We have five airports that are flying directly to our seven regions that we currently go to. We have direct flights, and we have time-sensitive material, which is food.
Dairy products need to get overseas in a hurry. Y International is just the latest in a long and growing list of foreign food companies in the state, says Michelle Brown. She's president of Choose New Jersey, an industry-funded nonprofit that tries to attract business.
We have nearly 2,000 food businesses in our state. We have more than 190 world headquarters of food companies in our state.
Still, New Jersey? The food capital of America? Really?
Really, New Jersey.
Brown rattles off the way her state is the ideal place to import-export food.
We have great rail. Great rail that crisscrosses the state, that goes... Warehousing in the state of New Jersey is probably the hottest industry right now. You can reach 22 million consumers in 2 hours.
And if you're a foreign food company looking to launch in the U.S., the state has the only so-called soft landing food incubator in the nation. That means they'll hold your hand to get your product launched. At Rutgers University's Food Innovation Center, bottles of a new tea are being tested. I met there with Executive Director Lou Cooperhouse.
So they're going to make the tea in the kettle, and they pump it overhead. And then it comes down here and gets filled.
Cooperhouse says many of his international customers think the biggest challenge selling in the U.S. will be regulatory. It's not.
Their biggest challenge is actually marketing. It's such a competitive landscape in America. It is so different than the European market. So it's really important that they really differentiate themselves. Just because a product sells well in Europe, it's easily to get lost in America.
Now here's the part of the story where the reporter would introduce a Spanish, Italian, or Belgian company that's using these services. And I was supposed to meet up with a Greek Euros company in southern New Jersey, but things didn't exactly work out. So I had to speak with Takis Solomos in Athens via speakerphone.
I apologize for not being able to coordinate with my colleagues
The phone connection wasn't the best. Solomos is an investor with Megas Euros. They make kebab meats. He says they work with Rutgers to get advice on food safety regulations, marketing, and figuring out what will sell in the U.S.
We know that we can pick up a phone and make a call to a friend, get some assistance. You know, the guys there are great.
Even when they're giving candid but harsh advice. Solomos says they were ready to roll out a style of Greek sausage for American consumers. Then Lou Cooperhouse and his team weighed in.
I actually liked it, but I knew it was different. We were unusually split. Like half the group literally hated it. This was like a combination of flavors that was out there. You know, it was just, but anyway, well, that being said, so I got back with an honest answer and said, no.
Better to hear that before you go to market. The folks in New Jersey do want Greek sausages to be a winner. Back in the lab, Cooperhouse says successful foreign products mean more jobs in New Jersey.
The county that we're in, Carmel County, is actually the poorest county in terms of per capita income in the entire state. We're also in one of the poorest cities of over 500 cities in New Jersey. But we're really taking a very aggressive route at the globalization of the food economy.
At the end of the day, Cooperhouse and others in the state think they've got enough to offer. So when foreign food companies think of coming to the U.S., they'll think first of the Garden State.
So we're really taking the mentality of Hollywood, as it is to entertainment, and applying that same logic to having New Jersey being the cluster for the food sector.
And the award for Best Imported Greek Kebab goes to? Yeah. For the World, Jason Margolis, Bridgeton, New Jersey.
If you're wondering what 600 bags of rice zooming through a production line looks like, we've got a video for you at PRI.org. Turkey's largest city, Istanbul, has several must-see historical sites. One of them is the Hagia Sophia. Picture a beautiful, massive dome surrounded by four minarets. It's a majestic building with a long and complex history. Built in the 6th century as an Eastern Orthodox Christian cathedral, it was converted into a mosque in the 15th century under the Ottoman Empire. And in the 20th century, it became a museum when Turkey went secular. Now some religious conservatives want the Hagia Sophia to become a mosque again. My BBC colleague Selen Girit joins me from Istanbul. First of all, Selen, for those of us not familiar with the Hagia Sophia, why is it so important to Turkish identity?
It is Istanbul's most spectacular building, and an increasing number of Turks are calling for this building, Hagia Sophia, to be converted into a mosque. They're saying this is very important for the Turkish identity and for the predominantly Muslim population. Whether it will remain as a museum is often debated.
So why are these religious conservatives pushing for this now?
They have been pushing for it for many years now, ever since the Islamist AKP government came into power. But recent years have seen an increase in these protests and calls for Hagia Sophia to be reconverted into a mosque. Last year, in August, for instance, protests took place within Hagia Sophia. One man wearing a T-shirt depicting the Turkish flag said, "This is a mosque," cried out loud, and said, "We should be allowed to pray here." And very recently, last month, members of a well-known right-wing ultranationalist group recited the Islamic call to prayer inside Hagia Sophia. So we are seeing an increase on these calls of converting this place into a mosque, but no such step has been taken yet.
You're a resident of Istanbul, Selin. What are your memories of the Hagia Sophia? Do you remember when you first visited it?
Well, I was born in Istanbul myself some decades ago. And as a kid, as an elementary school kid, we used to be taken to the historic sites across Istanbul. And Hagia Sophia was one of them. And we were, of course, mesmerized. Recently, last year, actually, I went to see the place for myself once again. And it is still mesmerizing. It is one of the places that has hosted Christianity and Islam as well. And in that sense, it has so many religious connotations too. But it also is economically important, I have to say. There are millions of tourists coming to Istanbul every year. And visiting Hagia Sophia is worth tens of millions of dollars to the municipalities surrounding this area.
So the push to change the Hagia Sophia back to a mosque, is it just one more sign that Turkey is turning more towards this Islamic identity? And what other signs are you seeing of this in Turkey right now?
Well, this is only one of the signs that the country moving towards Islam and moving away from secularism. Just this week, for instance, Turkey's top religious authority issued a dictionary on its website where it said adolescents for boys would start at the age of 12, and for girls it would start at the age of 9, and whoever reached the age of adolescence would have the right to marry. This would, of course, mean that girls at the age of 9 could marry in that sense.
That's
and secularists. Yes, and secularist circles across Turkey went into a frenzy after this statement was seen on the website. And the directorate said that wasn't actually a new statement. It was just an interpretation of Islam, and they didn't actually support child marriage. But still, secularists in Turkey feel more and more concerned about what might happen next.
My colleague at the BBC, Selin Girit, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Venezuela's economy is in a severe recession, which means it's hard to get even the basics there, like food and medicine. That and the political turmoil in the country have pushed many Venezuelans to pick up and leave if they can afford to. Critics accuse the socialist government of President Nicolas Maduro of mismanaging the economy. Exhibit A, the collapse of what was once the government's cash cow, the state-owned oil giant known as PDVSA. And it's a baffling collapse in many ways because Venezuela has the largest proven oil reserves in the world. Yeah, even larger than Saudi Arabia's. So where's all that oil money going, and why is output down? Francisco Manaldi is a Venezuelan oil expert at Rice University in Houston. He says the country's oil industry has been shrinking for a long time due to a number of factors.
The first one was a massive political conflict that led to an oil strike in 2003, in which President Chavez fired the majority of the top management and the engineers. Then he partly nationalized the private companies that operated in the country, and also started extracting most of the resources from the oil company that were used to invest in order to finance his social programs and other, you know, international programs that he had. And eventually, when the price of oil collapsed in 2014, these factors combined to a dramatic collapse in the last few years of up to almost a million barrels decline in just 4 years.
I would also guess that the Venezuelan government is just not investing that much in the oil industry because they don't have the money. Therefore, the oil industry isn't getting maintained.
Yes, I mean, this is an ongoing problem. It started even before the collapse in the price of oil, but now it's really dramatic. Venezuela needs to invest about $8 billion just to keep production at the level at around, you know, the 2 million barrels that it was a few months ago. And they are investing probably half of that or less. And that, of course, is creating all sorts of problems. Of course, the decline in production, but also shortages of gasoline domestically because of lack of investment in the refinery, accidents, a lot of environmental issues. You know, the Venezuelan oil industry is an environmental mess of massive proportions.
What would happen to Venezuela if the global price of oil were to start spiking suddenly? Would they be okay?
Well, in the short run, it will be very difficult to get back production up because, you know, the Venezuelan national oil company owes money to every single service company. It has a lot of difficulties in managing the basic maintenance of their facilities. And they have committed a lot of their existing production to repay loans from China and Russia. In addition to that, basically gasoline and all oil refined products are almost free inside Venezuela. So all these factors make it relatively hard for them to benefit from an increase in the price of oil. However, if the increase is significant, of course, it will help them with their cash flow and to solve some of their problems in the short term.
So many disadvantages and challenges. What is your prescription for Venezuela getting out of this mess?
Well, it requires a comprehensive reform of the economy because basically, you know, we have currently exchange rate controls. The Venezuela is in default and is not paying the external debt, including, you know, PDVSA, the national company. So you need to do a macroeconomic reform. But as part of that reform, the Venezuelan oil industry has to be open up to foreign investment. It is already open, but in a way that it's credible with institutions that make it clear to investors that they will be able to recover their investments and they will be get paid. And also, of course, the national company has to be depoliticized, has to be professionalized again, and has to be left with enough money to invest. But of course, because today that competes with putting money into imports, it's very hard. And that's why it's really important, the component of foreign private investment to recover oil production.
How eager are foreign investors to get into a dysfunctional Venezuela right now?
Yeah, well, that's, of course, a difficult problem to tackle because of the lack of credibility and, of course, the crime rates and all the macroeconomic issues. But Venezuela has one of the most prolific endowments of oil in the world. It's very well located to supply some markets, including the U.S. market. And the heavy oil that Venezuela produces is needed in some of the refineries of the world. So there is some interest. It will be easy to get them back. But, you know, even today, it's very important to notice that of the $1.8 million that Venezuela produces, about $1 million is produced in joint ventures with foreign partners. Mm. So it's not the part that with foreign partners that has declined. It is the national oil company's own operated production that has dramatically collapsed.
Francisco Manaldi at Rice University in Houston, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Colombia is keeping a close eye on Venezuela, their neighbors, and the Colombian government is nervous about any turmoil spilling over the border. After all, Colombians are still just getting used to peace and stability after decades of civil war in their country. We're going to hear now from a band that tries to capture a little bit of Colombia's current reality, an electronic duo called Cero 39. And here's one half of that duo, Dario Sendoya, a.k.a. Kid Watusi.
Cero 39, it's a project from Bogotá, Colombia. We do electronic music with folkloric elements from Latin American tradition, musical traditions. I think Cero 39 is a kind of thermometer of what is happening in Colombia. If our feelings are hopeless, or if our feelings are more like seeing the future with more hope, I think we really like explore the political way, but from the ground, from the everyday lives of the people. The song that we are hearing is Mucura. Mucura, it's a song with different elements. Fredo, my partner, imagined this song when he was blocked in a tropical island in Colombia. So there is a little bit of storm inside, but all the elements also of electronic languages and hip-hop and champeta, that is a traditional mixed music from the Caribbean in Colombia. I think Mucura, it's a good example of these feelings of the Latin American landscapes that we want to like share with the people with these electronic languages.
Dario Sendoya of the Bogota electronic duo Cero 39. Their tune Mucura takes us out today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in a snowy Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow after we dig ourselves out from today's bomb cyclone. I'm off to grab a shovel. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.